Connie Sepko is an HHMI investigator and professor of genetics and ophthalmology at Harvard Medical School. Her lab studies the retina, a layer of nervous system tissue in the back of the eye, as a model for central nervous system development. Cells in the retina sense and interpret light and relay visual information back to the brain via the optic nerve. As part of their studies, the Sepko lab develops gene therapies to treat retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, a form of retinal degeneration in which rod cells, photoreceptors responsible for night vision, die first, followed by cones, photoreceptors responsible for color vision, eventually leading to blindness. In their work, the Sepko lab uses adenovirus-associated vectors, or AAVs, to deliver genes that they hope will prevent the death of cone cells. The Sepko lab has also recently begun developing plasmid-based tools that use GFP as a scaffold to activate gene expression or recombination in a cell-specific manner. We recently asked Professor Sepko to chat with us to learn more about her work. All right, so projects in your lab range from those answering questions about basic developmental biology to highly applied efforts to improve gene therapy tools that can be used to modify gene expression in vivo. But most things have something to do with the eye. So what got you interested in working on the eye in the first place?
So when I was finishing my postdoc, I was working on viruses, which I had also worked on as a grad student. And I was thinking that I would like to do something a little bit more unique, because many people were involved in making retroviral vectors, which is what I was doing at the time. And it felt a little redundant. So I thought about why was I in biology? I did a bit of soul searching, and I realized, you know, I really liked the big unanswered questions that we have in biology. And I felt that there was so much to do, why was I doing the same thing as other people were doing? So then I started thinking about, you know, where are the big unanswered questions in biology? And I thought neuroscience was a great area because, you know, we don't understand learning, memory, emotions, et cetera. So, but I knew nothing about neuroscience. So I went to a course. Actually, I was at MIT at the time. I came over to Harvard Med School and sat in on Furchpan and Potter's neuroscience course that they taught to the med students. And I loved it, but it was over my head. I didn't understand most of it. I had never had any background in what I call whole animal biology. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, thinking about the nervous system in a more reductionist way, I thought, okay, well, where do all these neurons come from? Started thinking about the developmental biology questions. And I thought of a way to use the viruses that I had been generating as a postdoc to then track lineages in vivo. Mm-hmm. And in considering how to do that technically, the eye was the best place to do that because there were cells that were generated relatively late in nervous system development that were accessible to inoculations with the virus, and the eye was just pretty handy in terms of that. So I started thinking about the eye from the standpoint of an accessible model of the brain, which is what it is. But then I also just fell in love with the biology of the eye. So I've been studying the retina ever since.
Mm-hmm. And so your kind of work on retroviral vectors and viral vectors in general pushed you over into, is that what kind of got you interested in doing like the gene therapy type things that you did with the eye?
Yes and no. Later, I mean, or? Yeah, the history that I have with viral vectors kept me interested in viral vectors. Mm-hmm. And our work in the eye involved a lot of genes which, when mutant, lead to blindness in people. And so I sort of had in the back of my mind that it would be possible someday to do gene therapy in the eye. And there's a few things that kind of colluded to send us in that direction. One was that I got a call from sort of a friend who's family just had a child that was born blind, mm-hmm. and they wanted to know what were we doing to help such children, and I had to say nothing, and that made me think about that, and he asked me to think about that, so I did. This was Brent and Schwartz family, and then I also had become aware that AAVs, these are viruses that can be used effectively in gene therapy, had been tested in dogs for good transduction. This was Gene Bennett's and Al McGuire's work down at Penn, and I saw, oh, okay, AAVs work.
Was that specifically in the eye, or?
They had worked in the eye.
Yeah.
And I was aware of all the reasons why gene therapy had encountered problems using other kinds of viruses and other kinds of tissues. And I reasoned that all of the reasons that caused the failures elsewhere didn't pertain to the eye, and I can talk about that if you want.
But sure, yeah.
It looked like it was a good target organ, mm-hmm. for gene therapy in principle, mm-hmm. and then the AAVs showed that just by good fortune, they happened to have a lot of good features for the eye. So hearing about you know, a disease that affected a newborn child in a more personal way, and then knowing that AAVs were going to work, and then theoretically understanding that the eye would be a good place for gene therapy, and our work on developing tissues, retinal cells, that you know, had let us know how devastating it is when certain genes are mutant. All of those things, I guess, then made us go in the direction of trying to apply gene therapy for the retina.
Sure. Yeah, so it was kind of like the personal connection and then like the
The history
of,
and the
scientific factors
and all
that.
Yes, all those things.
Yeah. So yeah, as you were saying, so the eye is particularly good for gene therapies. Why is that?
So the there's a couple features. So I think one very important thing to consider if you're thinking about gene therapy is the target cell type. And A, whether it's dividing, and B, how accessible is it?
Mm-hmm.
And if you're using a dividing tissue, let's say a bone marrow-derived hematopoietic cell, you have to use a virus that integrates. Otherwise, it just gets the vector gets diluted out as the cell divides. And in fact, the hematopoietic tissues were one of the ones that were thought to be the best target initially for gene therapy because people had already worked out removing bone marrow cells, manipulating them in the lab, and then putting them back in. So it seemed like it'd be an obvious target, and it was. And some of the first gene therapy used retroviral vectors to introduce genes. This is for the boy in the bubble disease. And unfortunately, I mean, and the virus, in order to replicate, has to integrate into the host genome, and it can cause insertional effects, which it did, which led to some problems, some leukemias, actually. So having a target cell that divides, though, dictates that you use an integrating virus.
Yeah.
So if you have a target cell that's not dividing, as in the case for photoreceptors, the target cell that we're talking about, you don't have to risk the integrating type of virus. So that was a very big thing right there, is you don't have to use integrating virus. The second thing that has hurt some aspects of gene therapy is inflammation in response to viral capsids.
Okay.
So the tragic story of Jesse Gelsinger at Pennsylvania, he was transduced with a large amount of adenovirus, which is an inflammatory capsid. And unfortunately, it led to his death, this inflammation response. And if you're going to treat a large organ like the liver, which was the target organ for him, then the body gets exposed to a lot of virus. Okay, so if there's any problem with either the capsids or something in the prep, there's a huge exposure there. If you're treating the eye, it's just a tiny tissue.
Sure, it's a small amount to inject.
Yeah, so a small amount to inject. And furthermore, another advantage is the overall body doesn't get exposed. It's all contained. So even if you look at, you know, for genomes outside of the eye, it's hard to find them even by PCR. So you have this small target organ self-contained, another benefit. It also means from the standpoint of creating enough inoculum to treat, you don't need as much. So that's good from a manufacturing standpoint. And another thing that hurt gene therapy or has, especially from the AAV standpoint, is we have pre-existing antibodies. Most humans have some kind of exposure. And so we have circulating antibodies
against
to the capsids.
AAVs in particular.
So you can search for people who either don't have the antibodies for the capsid that you're intending to use, or you can try to develop new capsids where there's no pre-existing antibodies and those approaches are being taken. But the other advantage of the eye is it seems to be a bit protected against the circulating antibodies or T cells that are responding in some cases to infected cells. So we have this sort of at least immune privilege, which may not be absolute, but it's better than, again, the whole body exposure. So all of those things argue in favor. And the last thing I'll say is that it's fairly easy to hit a lot of the target cells, which in our case are photoreceptors from one inoculation. If you're going into, let's say, some large area of the brain, for example. It's just there's not one needle track that's going to hit most of the cells. So we have this other very nice advantage of delivery, access of the cell type that you want to infect.
Yeah, so that was the next question I was going to ask. So in terms of actually doing targeting, a lot of it is just through the physical, like put the needle in the eye and get it exactly to the cells that you want to get it to.
Yeah, so people are even innovating on that. So the thing that we do in the lab is we put the needle right in the vicinity of the photoreceptor cells. It's an area called the subretinal space. For people, there's a little more risk of doing that than one might want to assume, although I would say that one still has to think about that as perhaps not that high risk, but there's some risk. So people are also innovating on the type of capsids that one can inject by altering the capsid so that if you inject instead of the subretinal space, doing something called the vitreal injection, which is inside of your eyeball, there's a gelatinous mass, which is called the vitreous. It's fairly easy to target People are injected every 6 weeks if they have macular degeneration by inoculations into that space. It's low risk. Mm-hmm. So if virions can be delivered there and still traverse the retina to get to the target cell type, which is the photoreceptor, then one has even safer delivery. Mm-hmm. But either way, one can actually target the photoreceptors with a reasonable, fairly simple kind of inoculation.
Yeah. Okay, and then in terms of once you get everything into the eye, the actual treatment prospects themselves, kind of where are we right now in terms of treating macular degeneration or other kind of retinopathies?
Yeah.
And are we close to actually even maybe solving blindness for some people? And what are the things that we still need to overcome?
Yeah, so I think the first thing to consider is the genetic heterogeneity that leads to blindness. So there's over 220 disease genes in humans mm-hmm. that lead to blindness. Many of them directly affect the photoreceptors. Mm-hmm. Some it's not clear what their etiology is. They might be broadly expressed, but one still does get effects in photoreceptors. Mm-hmm. Some of the ocular diseases don't have clear genetics associated with them. So if we start with the easier ones, which are the ones where we understand something about the disease gene, let's say the ones that and that's why we chose a disease to work on where things are pretty clear. We work mm-hmm. on one called retinitis pigmentosa. Mm-hmm. Still, that one has, I think, at the moment, 64 disease genes associated with it. But the clarity that comes from looking at that disease is that those disease genes, by and large, are expressed only in the rod photoreceptors. These are the ones that are active in dim light. Mm-hmm. And so then it's understandable why a person is born without dim light vision or without night vision. And that would actually be fine in this day and age of electricity for lights, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But then subsequently cones die, the ones that we use in bright light for color vision.
Right.
And that's the tragedy of RP. So the rationale to treat that disease is not too difficult. You can either replace the defective rod gene. Mm-hmm. Let's say you have a recessive mutation, a loss of function. You can take an AAV, put in a good copy of the bad gene, in fact, and people are doing that.
Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to figure out. You said there's like 65 genes that could be associated with it. Do you go in and do sequencing or just look at those 65 genes and say, hey, which one is it?
Yep, you can do, you know, people have chips for diagnostics now for mm-hmm. for the DNA diagnostics. You know, if a family has had their disease gene discovered and is being tracked, you mm-hmm. would know what to do.
Yeah.
So the logic is very straightforward.
Right.
You take the bad gene, you put it in AAV, you infect at a mm-hmm. time when there's still cells left to save.
Yeah.
The bad part about that is that with so many different disease genes, you have to create so many different vectors. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but presumably at the moment, run clinical trials for each of those, which is prohibitively expensive mm-hmm. and logistically difficult.
Yeah.
So, but that's what people are doing. Mm-hmm. So there's a few test cases going on. We're trying to do something more generic mm-hmm. so that it's disease gene independent and just save cones regardless of what the rod mutation is. Mm-hmm. So again, the cones, which are the ones we want to save, they're the ones we use for our color daylight vision mm-hmm. and high acuity vision.
Yeah.
Those cones don't express the disease gene.
Yeah.
So something is going on to create problems for those cones. They stop working and then they die.
Yeah.
And we're hoping that's generic, that mm-hmm. problem. And that sort of course of disease pertains to animal models as well as humans. So mm-hmm. there's great animal models for this disease, and you see rods not functioning, rods dying, cones dysfunctioning, cones dying. The disease genes are in fact the same as are in humans. Mm-hmm. So we can start to work out, hopefully, a generic solution for the cone problems in this case. Mm-hmm. Now, you asked about the more general case of blindness and where are we? So one has to get really down into the weeds on the details of each of those other disease genes, what mm-hmm. cell type is being affected, what kind of effects are there. Is there a rationale for either protecting the cells that are not working or restoring function to the cells that are not working? And some of those we don't have such a clear idea of what to do.
Yeah.
But I think the fact that the AAV is effective mm-hmm. and so far safe should spur on investigation into many of those other diseases. Would they be amenable to a gene therapy approach? Mm-hmm. And my guess is some will, some won't. Mm-hmm. And it really will depend on the details of what cell type, how early do you have to deliver, what kind of, you have to have regulated levels of expression, how many cells need to be transduced to get an effect. Mm-hmm. Do multiple cell types need to be hit? Do you need the right kind of promoter to really adjust the levels? The real details of gene therapy are what you'd have to consider for many of the other diseases.
Sure. And so do you think, given the problem that you said before, where you have to develop so many different vectors because there are so many different genes involved. Yeah. Is there really a push by even companies to like want to fund trials for so many different types of gene therapies, or are they just going to go after ones that there's a really prominent gene that affects a lot of people, will they go after that one?
I think they'll definitely try to go after the more common diseases. And again, if there is a generic solution, which is disease gene independent, and you can imagine a couple, and just some of the ones that are being investigated already do have company backing. So for example, if you have rods die again due to many idiosyncratic problems, many different disease genes, and we're going to say, okay, the rods can go, we can get by without night vision. But to protect cones or restore function in cones that are ailing, let's say due to the loss of the rods, one approach is to add an optogenetic protein. So optogenetic proteins allow a cell to be light sensitive that ordinarily might not be light sensitive. So if you had cones that, let's say, weren't able to detect light using their normal mechanisms, they're too sick for some reason, and you give them an optogenetic protein, at least in mice, this will allow the cones to sense light a bit longer. So that's a generic disease-independent approach. And there is a company in Europe that's pursuing that.
Second, the name of that company?
GenSight. Then you can also deliver an optogenetic protein to the next neuron sort of downstream in the information chain. And these are called bipolar neurons. This is also being approached. So if you have all your photoreceptors gone, you can say, well, we'll give the retina light sensitivity by delivering an optogenetic protein to these bipolar cells, and that's being done. You can say, let's deliver a growth factor that might just keep the cells, all cells, happy and healthy longer. That would be, again, disease gene independent. That's also being done. So I think that you can imagine, and I mean, I could talk about our approach too, which we're hoping is disease gene independent, but you can see that people are coming up with strategies that won't require making a different vector for every family, but might help many families. And that, I think, is more promising and more practical in the long run. And certainly companies agree with that because that's some of the things that they're backing.
So sort of along those lines, is because you're dealing with... the disease genes usually end up killing the rods, like you said, and then the cones.
Well, for retinitis pigmentosa.
So, and that's the specific one that you're studying. And so the cones will die eventually. Is there a specific age range where you really have
It's very broad.
Okay.
So people can start losing their color vision, let's say in their 20s, all the way out to their 60s. And even in the same family, apparently, the disease on, or the loss of daylight vision can vary a lot. And so we don't know why it varies so much. There could be modifier genes. There could be environmental influences. Could be both. There could be stochastic. But yeah, it's a wide range, which is one of the other things that I like about this disease. There's a pretty good window where you can get in and hopefully delay the loss of cones. And maybe if you don't delay it forever, but you at least slow down the loss of color vision, then that's already a good thing.
And so could you go in a little bit more detail about the things that you're developing in your lab? That would be useful.
So we've been asking, well, why are the cones dying? The cones don't express the disease gene. So it's sort of an innocent bystander effect. They're getting knocked off by something that's happened secondary to rod loss. And we actually got four mouse models of RP and tracked, well, when exactly do the cones die? And it's after most of the rods die. And you can make various models for why, but we decided to look using RNA expression data across four different mouse models and ask, is there something in common among the four mouse models that happens about the time the cones start to die? And one thing we found was that metabolic pathways appear to be disarranged or deranged, I should say. So we looked at that, and the cones seem to be going through chaperone-mediated autophagy. They look like they're starving. So we're working on helping cones with nutrition, basically giving them things like transporters that might increase glucose uptake and things like that. And we don't know if that's going to work. We also, in our reading and thinking about this, became aware of the work of other labs showing that cones suffer from oxidation. When the rods die, the oxygen keeps coming, and the rods are the main cell type, actually. So when rods go, the oxygen keeps coming, and the cones are bombarded. They show oxidation. So we decided to add a transcription factor that fights oxidation. This is called NRF2. And NRF2 turns on hundreds of genes that fight oxidation as well as other kinds of stress. So we delivered NRF2 with an AAV vector. And we do have longer survival and function of the cones. Mm-hmm. And this is across a couple different disease models, so we're hoping that means it's generic. This is all in mice.
Sure.
So we're very happy about that, and now we're going to large animal models to mm-hmm. see if it works in larger animals. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how well that goes.
And so with things like that where you're not just kind of, well, not replacing a gene that's known to be broken, do you worry more about like potential side effects that could come from overexpressing this and getting expression levels right and all that good stuff?
Yeah, so we do worry about that. So far, so good. We've put it into wild-type mice. We haven't seen any deleterious effects. Mm-hmm. And I should say we have seen deleterious effects for other genes. Mm-hmm. So NRF2 was beneficial and not deleterious to wild-type mice, but we put in another transcription factor that also regulates antioxidation genes. This one's called PGC1-alpha, mm-hmm. and it was deleterious. Mm-hmm. So certainly we're aware that there can be deleterious effects, and at the moment, basically all we can do is screen for them. Mm-hmm. But it is a worry.
Yeah.
And you know, we'll have to figure out what to do about it should we encounter some of that. Mm-hmm. But so far, so good anyways.
Mm-hmm. And thinking along those lines, are there things that you could do that would be antioxidants that wouldn't be gene therapy related, but just antioxidants that you could give to somebody? Maybe you could inject them in the eye or something like that. That could have the same effect. Have you guys looked into things?
Yeah, so
like
people have actually tried that. So Peter Campicciaro's lab at Hopkins gave very high levels of antioxidants in diet, and they also did some injections, and they also saw less cone death. Now, there's a couple problems, though, I think, with that as a long-term strategy. So people do have the onset of these problems slow and over decades. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear you can keep levels up high enough, and also it might not be a good idea to do it systemically. So mm-hmm. if you're imagining a dietary or an eye drop kind of scenario, mm-hmm. It's not clear that a dietary or an eye drop scenario would work in terms of getting therapeutic levels of antioxidants to the eye. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you've gotten systemic exposure to a high load usually, mm-hmm. and that could be deleterious also because mm-hmm. there are normal sort of free radical signaling pathways going on in the body. So we think that sort of decades-long high antioxidants might not be a good idea,
sure.
but we're not even sure it's effective in terms of a long-term kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. Injections you wouldn't want to do for decades either, mm-hmm. you know, injecting into the eye.
Yeah.
So, and small molecules tend to diffuse. Mm-hmm. So if you were going to do an eye-specific long-term delivery, you'd have to come up with a gel, a pump, or some kind of delivery device that might be effective, which one could imagine doing.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that sort of regulated delivery that's reversible, that is stable, might be a good way to go.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing one could imagine doing is using viruses that have promoters that are regulatable, if mm-hmm. one wanted to turn things off.
Sure.
And who knows, with the advent of CRISPR or Cas9, you know, maybe there's also ways to actually delete out a therapeutic gene if it turns out it's a problem.
Yeah.
So I think going forward, I would say that, you know, I like the stability actually of the AAV, and mm-hmm. should it become a problem with side effects, we'll have to figure out how to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I like it over the chemical approaches right now mm-hmm. for the specificity.
And I guess kind of the last question I have about the gene therapy stuff in the eye, mm-hmm. With the AAVs, how long-term do you think that the treatment will be? I guess in mice, you've probably gone out as far as you can go and still been able to see effects. Will it last a whole lifetime for a human?
Well, that's the hope. I mean, the amazing thing is, and this just is good luck. I mean, it could have been that AAV genomes get degraded or turned off or something, but the first inoculations that were done at Penn, they went into a dog, and I believe one shot as a puppy, and the dog still had therapeutic effect at 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in people, it's now gone on for, I believe, the longest trial is 8 years, and there's still expression.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we don't know mm-hmm. of a shutoff.
Yeah.
It still could be the case that that will happen, but I think once you get by the first, you know, couple weeks, couple months or something with gene therapy vectors, my guess is if they stay on past that point, they're going to stay on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it remains to be seen. You cannot do it that long, right,
in
a mouse. They only have a 2-year lifespan. So, you know, there are other animals that might go longer, as I mentioned, the dog, but I think we're going to have to basically go to people eventually mm-hmm. to get the decades kind of data that we'd like to get. But so far, so good. I mean, we mm-hmm. don't know of a turnoff.
Mm-hmm. And everything right now is kind of being controlled by just high expressing promoters, like they said, megalovirus promoter and things like that, or is it a more fine tuning?
Yeah, there's so the Leber's congenital amaurosis vector, which is the first one that went into people. One group used the promoter for the gene, which is called RPE65. It's a fairly weak promoter. It may not be actually as effective as one would like, but it is the endogenous gene promoter. The other group used one of these higher level CAG type promoters, which uses the chicken beta actin promoter and the CMV enhancer. And both worked. I believe the emerging data is that the non-regulated higher one might work better. So, you know, on principle, one would think, oh, you want to use a regulated promoter, endogenous to the gene of interest, endogenous to the cell type of interest. And I'd say on principle, that's probably sound. In practice, I'm not sure that's always correct. The other thing is the AAV vectors are small. You're not going to be able to put in a large regulatory region with all the bells and whistles, which might, you know, regulate in response to any cue. So you're forced into a small sort of bite-sized piece for the promoter. And so, so far, again, I don't know that using something like the CAG promoter created a problem. Could in the future. And we're using that right now as well. So I think we just don't have enough experience to know you know, how do you really achieve fine-tuned, regulated, perfect promoter activity in a small vector?
So that actually kind of brings me into some of my next questions, which, so you guys have developed means of electroporating at least the mouse eye and getting a lot of multiple vectors in at once. And so is that kind of where we need to go in terms of the like doing human therapies now, is getting multiple vectors in at once? And is that something that you're working on or will be working on?
So the electroporation is pretty crude, and I don't think it's good for human therapy for two reasons. One is that it works most effectively in mitotic cells. So they're no longer present at the time most diseases have an onset. And again, you, if you're going to deliver DNA, you want to put the DNA right in the vicinity of the mitotic cells and then apply a charge across the membrane. And you don't usually have a convenient site where you can inject where the plasmids are going to be right next to the mitotic population. So that's number one, a limitation. Number two, shocking it in could be also problematic. The third
shocking
thing is...
Shocking people's eyes probably not.
Although, you know, maybe it wouldn't be bad. Who knows? The mice are fine when we do this. But, you know, I just think the mitotic target population is not sitting there. So you just don't really have access to the cells that you want to ultimately have the delivery to. And these plasmids don't integrate. They get diluted out. They do get shut off eventually. So for long term, it's not even so good. So even if you could do it, you don't get long term. Now, maybe you don't want long term for everything, but for many things we're thinking about, we do want long term. So I think the electroporation is really not a good therapeutic. From a viral standpoint, even though, as I said, AAV is small, we have been able to get such high titer virus that we can get co-infection with three vectors with a very high efficiency. So that allows us to put in multiple genes. So one of the strategies we've done, we can put four genes in by distributing them into three viruses and infecting. So I think it's not insurmountable to use, to deliver multiple genes using AAV. Really big genes don't work. There are strategies we can have them go in pieces or do various kind of, you know, get transplicing or complementing protein domains and things of that nature. That's, you know, something to be pursued, but you can also switch over to a bigger capacity virus like a lentivirus. And again, for the eye, people have been trying that for one of the big target genes that they're interested in delivering. So I think there's possibilities if you have a big gene or if you need multiple gene delivery, just high titer AAVs do give multiple, you know, infections into the same cell. So,
All right. So the I guess the next kind of questions I had were more about the tools that you guys are developing in your lab. So you guys are developing a variety of tools that allow researchers to modify gene expression specifically in cells expressing GFP. And these tools use GFP as a scaffold to activate the function of the transcription factors and recombinases and obviate the need to create complicated transgenic lines that have already been made using GFP. So what prompted your lab to make these tools? And are you planning on expanding the types of activities that can be turned on using GFP? And kind of where is it going from here?
Yeah, so the motivation here was a graduate student, Jonathan Tang, joined the lab, and he was interested and working with a specific cell type in the retina called the bipolar cells. Mm-hmm. So these are an interneuron type, and they participate in information processing. Mm-hmm. And we were interested in both their development and their function. And as you probably know, in order to target a specific cell type, especially when you're working in a complicated tissue like the nervous system, it's nice to have specific regulation so you can target one particular type. And the bipolars, at the time, we knew there were 13 types, and mm-hmm. we wanted to be able to individually manipulate. So type X, Y, or Z, if we had a way to just ask something about its development, something about its connectivity, it would really give much more interpretable answers. So in order to do that, if you have a recombinase expressed in a specific cell type, let's say Cre in cell type X, you can then turn genes on and off just in cell type X or even just label cell type X. Turned out there weren't good recombinase lines mm-hmm. in specific subtypes of bipolars, or at least not specific enough for our purposes.
And that was just because
people hadn't made them. Yeah. So Jonathan was looking in the literature trying to find these recombinase lines, and he kept coming up against the fact that there were GFP lines mm-hmm. that were interesting. And we would sit and bemoan the fact that there were these nice GFP lines. They didn't allow us to do the genetic manipulations we wanted to do. And Jonathan's just very clever, and he started then out of frustration thinking, well, what could we do with GFP? Mm-hmm. And he started reading and thinking about it, and he came across GFP nanobodies, mm-hmm. which are a special type of antibody coming from camelids. And he basically came up with the idea that he could take a nanobody to GFP, take another nanobody to GFP, two that could co-occupy, make fusion proteins using conventional DNA technology, express them in GFP cells, and have the nanobodies scaffold a new activity on the GFP. Mm-hmm. So he conceived of it that way, and then he worked it out in tissue culture and got it to work. And so it's been fantastic. You know, as you mentioned, you can turn on transcription in cells that express GFP using this method. You can turn on Cre activity in mm-hmm. cells. And we are expanding it. So Jonathan's had other ideas in collaboration with other people in the lab. And we're looking at expanding beyond GFP, mm-hmm. using antibodies to other proteins.
And more fluorescent proteins or just other anything?
And we're hoping endogenous proteins.
Okay.
So that you can have nanobodies directed against endogenous proteins. So mm-hmm. let's say if you're working in a non-model organism where you don't have GFP,
yeah.
but you do have some epitope or some protein expressed in a specific cell type. Mm-hmm. If you had a nanobody to that protein, mm-hmm. in theory, you should be able to do the same thing.
And then do it cell type specifically based on the natural expression.
Exactly.
That's super cool.
Yeah. So that's one idea. And the limiting factor right now is there aren't a huge repertoire of nanobodies. So it'd be nice to be able to have a faster way to generate nanobodies mm-hmm. to antigen of choice. So we're thinking about that and taking a few steps in that direction. We're also trying to make systems where you can have other kinds of activities mm-hmm. that are nanobody dependent, mm-hmm. nanobody and antigen dependent. Mm-hmm. So that's in the works too.
Have you guys been approached by anybody in like synthetic biology type labs that are?
We haven't really. Mm-hmm.
That's kind of surprising, just because they're very interested in like these kind of like logic circuits that yeah. get things started. So I would be surprised if somebody.
Well, Jonathan thinks of what he's doing as synthetic biology.
Sure.
I think he's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, he certainly has had conversations with people in terms of being approached. I don't know if I would say we've been approached, but certainly we discuss this with people who are synthetic biologists. Mm-hmm. So it does have that feel to it. It
yeah.
is, you know,
yeah.
you can think of it that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm more sort of basic biology based, so I tend to just think of this as a great set
a
of biological
tool.
Tools,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah. Which totally makes sense.
Yeah, me anyways.
So in terms of kind of some of the downstream things you guys are doing, do you see this ever potentially tying back into the stuff that you do with gene therapy in any way? I guess it would be kind of hard because you're already working with a line that has GFP, and that's not going to happen in a human, but
yeah.
maybe if you already have an epitope, like you were saying before, that you could mm-hmm. target, it could work that way.
Yeah, we've thought about disease applications from a couple different standpoints. There might be ways that you could manipulate a nanobody so that you created, let's say, a toxic situation in a cell you wanted to kill.
Mm-hmm.
That might be a good way to approach some virally infected cells
mm-hmm.
or just other cells that might have features that you don't that are deleterious. So nanobodies that create toxicity, for example, mm-hmm. might be useful. I mean, one of the nice things about this is that this is an intracellular delivery, if you can achieve that. And again, that really comes back almost to gene therapy, mm-hmm. if you want the,
yeah.
you know, I mean, I think the whole, you know, getting intracellular delivery to the target cell and enough target cells in a disease scenario is a limiting factor. I think the delivery is always an issue.
Yeah.
But if you can get a scheme where you can get delivery to the target cells, you can imagine using nanobodies to do various things mm-hmm. that can be therapeutic, either deleterious or positive.
Sure.
So we're thinking about, we haven't got great applications at the moment, mm-hmm. but that's a line that we're working on.
And keep our eyes open.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, now to kind of more questions about how your lab functions and your management style.
Mm-hmm.
We like to kind of give people a lot of advice about how they can kind of replicate other people's
okay.
success.
Yeah.
So you've kind of gone in a lot of different research directions. Mm-hmm. And what advice can you give to somebody if they want to mimic your success, like in terms of scope versus focus and what they should be working on? Should they have multiple projects going on at once? Always be open-minded, or would you prefer that people are really kind of zoom in on one particular thing?
Yeah, you know, I'm not sure there's a prescription for success in science. I mean, I think one of the really great things about being a scientist is that there are many different ways to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
And I've certainly noticed that from the time I was a grad student till now, that, you know, when I was a grad student, I used to notice that some people were complete slobs
mm-hmm.
and some people were super neat freaks, and mm-hmm. both could be successful.
Yeah.
And I've noticed that some people can be just all over the place in terms of topics, and some people can spend their whole life studying one very small thing, and both can be successful.
Mm-hmm.
I've noticed that some people are, you know, like to try new technologies as soon as they come out, and some people will wait until, you know, they're sure it works before they'll try it, and both people can be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one thing I really like about our field, is that there are many ways to be successful. I mean, for me personally, I like to try new things. I think it's part of the fun of doing science for me is technology development.
Mm-hmm.
I like developing new things. I think new tools really allow us to approach old questions in new ways. I think technology mm-hmm. has been just a huge force in certainly, you know, last 20, 30 years, right? I think
mm-hmm.
molecular biology has impacted everything.
Sure.
So anyhow, I like tool development. We do that for fun as well as for applications. I like being biologically based in tool development. I think that people who just develop tools for tool's sake sometimes don't have a good application, so
mm-hmm.
they have a neat tool but nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to make everything we do very application based. You
mm-hmm.
know, as I just told you,
sure.
you know, for the GFP thing, it was to access cells that have GFP.
Yeah.
Viral vectors, you know, we like to tinker with those, but it really is for in vivo gene delivery for therapeutics
mm-hmm.
or for basic science questions. So anyways, I like being biologically based.
Mm-hmm.
I like being open to sort of new technologies. You know, I like moving our biology along. Even if we don't develop a new tool, someone else does. So
mm-hmm.
we tend to be kind of early adopters on
yeah.
things.
Yeah. But always have some kind of experimental end goal in mind.
And
the tool just
yeah.
helps you out to get there.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess that's how we've done things.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of scope, I would say, you know, you could look at my lab also as a bit narrow in the sense that most of what we do does revolve around the eye. We just do it from a lot of different perspectives. I mean, some people study many different tissues,
mm-hmm.
and I'd say they're broader than what we do. But, you know, from the standpoint of asking different kinds of questions about the eye, we do it from, you know, we actually are doing circuitry now as well as development as well as degeneration. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, we do different angles on the problem, but
mm-hmm.
we're pretty invested in the eye.
Sure. So it's a similar thing where it's a lot of different types of disciplines and ideas about how to study something, but you're still focused on that one particular
yeah.
thing.
And for me, that sort of brings about a certain synergy. You know,
mm-hmm.
if we can look at our problem from different directions, either technically or biologically, it's sort of satisfying to try to gain an understanding of the tissue from all of those different directions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I pretty much stick in one direction. Plus, once you build up a certain level of knowledge and infrastructure,
mm-hmm.
It really does synergize across different approaches.
Sure, yeah. And then you can actually see how they could be useful to you. As opposed
yes,
to, yeah.
yes.
And then another question that I had was kind of about your mentorship style. What kind of lab do you run? Is it a very tight ship? Do people have to come in at certain times? You guys get to go and have fun together? Like,
yeah. Well, what we do is I do meet with everybody in the lab once a week. I try to meet one-on-one for an hour with everybody in the lab. I enjoy that very much. I hope that people in my lab do. It allows me to know what's going on, and I think it helps people also structure their own work to be able to talk about it once a week in a one-on-one kind of fashion. So that's one part of my mentoring style. I think another really important part of mentoring is that each person needs something different from me. And sometimes it takes me a while to figure out what that is. But I think that's something that I've learned over the years, is that there are different needs among my individual people in the lab. It's not just a student versus postdoc thing. And it's just different people have different needs. And
I'm sure the students themselves don't always know what those
they
needs
don't
are.
Always know. Sometimes they do, but most of the time not. And so, you know, the mentoring, I think, has to be done on a very individual basis. I think being sensitive to the different needs might be something that I would suggest is important, being a mentor. In terms of having fun in the lab, I mean, I hope most people enjoy being in the lab. They do a lot of things together. I'm not always that involved. I'm usually not that involved, but I think that the lab is a reasonably tight community. I think they enjoy each other.
So you like to culminate that atmosphere where people enjoy each other.
I certainly do. Yeah. It makes it much nicer for me too, if people get along.
And then sort of along your management style again, so I noticed when going through your website that the website is very well maintained, has a lot of information up there that's pretty easily accessible, easily digestible, kind of where I got a lot of my questions from. So do you put a lot of effort into that? And do you wish that more people put more effort into that type of thing?
Yeah, so we just, I'm glad you like it, because we just redid it a couple months ago. So Nicholas Lanfad, a postdoc in the lab, is a really good website person, and he brought to me the fact that he had recently joined the lab. He had a lot of expertise in this area, and WordPress was a platform that he was knowledgeable about, and it was fairly easy to use. So together we actually came up with the content. He did most of the actual uploading and configuring. I wrote most of the material. People in the lab contributed their images, and so that's sort of how we got it going. I hope we keep it up. It is, as I said, fairly new. The old version we had, I was the one who was actually doing the uploading and organizing and configuring on Dreamweaver, and I was not that good at it, and I just didn't put enough time in it, so it got out of date. So now that we have something that's actually easier for me as well, but also because we have Nico in the lab, hopefully we'll keep it up. And yeah, I enjoy when I go to someone else's lab website, if I can find what I need, or you know, like the aesthetics of it, the use of it is intuitive. You know, I appreciate that too.
Yeah, definitely. And then also in terms of just how you like to get information out to more than just people who are looking at your lab, do you focus on getting information out to people in the public, or you're very involved with grad students as well? You're co-director of the Leader Program in Human Biology. How important is just education of people in general to you?
Well, it's funny you ask, because last night we did the Science by the Pint activity. I don't know if you know this, but we have this fantastic group of students that have a group called Science in the News, and they have a lecture series. They just launched a podcast, and then about once a month they have a lab show up at a pub and meet with something like 50 to 100 people from the public show up. And last night I gave a quick sort of overview of what we do, and then people from my lab and I would sit at tables and talk to people, and that was a lot of fun. So I definitely enjoy that kind of thing, and I've given talks to the public a few times about our work. I mean, now that we do something applied like you know, this gene therapy work that we've talked about, I think it's more accessible to people than some of our basic science, although I also talk about our basic science, and I hope I make it accessible, but people are obviously interested in therapeutics, so I've given a number of lectures on that in various public settings. And I do think it's important that we do that.
And you've obviously done a great job of making stuff available through AdGene.
Love AdGene.
Yeah,
I think it's a great, I really do. I think it's a great organization. My lab benefits enormously. I think everybody does who needs constructs. So I think AdGene does an amazing service. And I think they're incredibly well run and professional about it. So, and now you guys are really a go-to source for information too. I mean, it used to be just plasmids, but for example, your CRISPR page, the things that you guys put up are really well done. So I think it's become evolving into a really an incredible information hub, as well as the plasma distribution source, and I think it's fantastic.
We'd like to thank Connie for taking the time to sit down and talk to us, and encourage you to follow the links in our associated blog post to learn more about the SEPCO Lab, their work, and their plasmids. Thanks for listening to the AdGene Podcast, a better way to share science.